Good morning.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, this is Monday morning, so, you know, Wednesday will sort of be like, well, I would like to, first of all, thank everyone for attending this morning. I know 8:30 is very early, and for someone like myself, I make sure I try not to get an 8:30 class registered. So this was a struggle for me, so I thank you all for showing up as well. I also like to state that I myself was not outside during the San Francisco win because I'm still waiting to be at a place where my school team wins the national championship, and unfortunately that is yet to happen, and it won't be happening this year because my two teams are Ohio State and North Carolina, which many of you may know is under a ban. Aside from that pessimistic note, I'm going to get started with getting started writing as a student. So really, the first thing you want to think about when you are thinking about how you want to write a paper is think about who you want to have as a mentor. And the great thing about being in these programs that we're all in is that you have a nice pool of researchers you can work with. But there are ways that you can sort of help yourself deal with finding mentors out of all those individuals you can be working with. So one of the first things you can think about, of course, is shared interests, such as, do you have similar interests research-wise as this individual? But when I say shared interests, I also mean shared research strategies, shared outlooks about how you deal with public health. For example, in epidemiology, there are certain epidemiologists who like to think of themselves as public health practitioners, that they have to use their findings to present public health findings. At the same time, there are other epidemiologists who take the stance that I'm just, you know, the guy or the gal writing the analyses. So the data is all I have to present. I can't make any speculation from those data. So you want to think about where your niche is and then find the faculty or the associates or even the upper graduate students who can help you further carve that niche out as well. One important thing to think about is that you are on the market starting on day one. You want to start thinking about who you can work with even before you think about writing a specific paper. So it's not a bad idea to start contacting potential mentors as soon as you arrive on campus, or perhaps even before you arrive, if you are entering a PhD program or entering a master's program as well. One of the things I like to recommend is it may be a good idea to contact a potential mentor by email, but also to consider the fact that they may be a chair, they may be a head of a large project, and it may be a good idea to check with the administrative assistant in the department just to make sure that your email isn't glossed over. I know, for example, one of the faculty members I work with is a chair of a large department and is working on a couple different grants, and he gets emails just pretty much every second of the day, and it's very possible for emails to get glanced over. So it's a good idea just to see if there's another way to get into communicating with that individual. So I wanted to show an example that I wrote 2 years ago when I was first thinking about going to UNC. I was a master's student at The Ohio State University, and I wanted to work with an individual named Dr. Stephen Marshall, who is currently my mentor and my advisor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So the two things I really wanted to point out is you want to be concise, you want to be direct and to the point. And so really with the email I wrote, luckily that I went back and found, I really just focused on saying, I'm researching the same thing you're working on. I want to do the projects that you're working on as well. I think also when you do get in touch with the individual that you want to work with or potentially want to work with, you want to think about the questions you want to ask this individual, because this could be a person you're working with for a very long time. So you want to think about, do they have the resources? And by resources, do they have the data? If you want to start writing papers, if they have a data set already established, it's an easier pathway to creating a paper as well. You want to think about, do they have funding for you? Unfortunately, we are in tough economic times, and having funding is something that we all have to think about. It was something I had to think about in choosing a PhD program, and I'm sure it's something everyone else in this room has thought about or is currently thinking about as well. The other thing to think about is if they have mentors, other mentees to assist in the guidance. A lot of professors, a lot of faculty utilize a pool, a research staff full of other graduate students. And those graduate students can provide you just as much leadership and mentorship as the faculty themselves. The other thing you want to think about is time management. Do they have that time management? You could be working with someone who is a big name, but they may just not have the time to work with you because they already have other mentees they are working with as well. So you really want to take this interview, it's this interview opportunity to think about, is this a right fit for me or not? So we're talking about individuals who could be good mentors. We want to think about what are some of the good qualities of these individuals. So I have a list here of a couple characteristics, and for time's sake, I just want to focus on a couple of ones that may be a little confusing without further explanation. For example, the last line, powerful, broadly defined. That doesn't mean in the sense of that on the hierarchy they're the, you know, all great creator of epidemiology for my example in my department. This means more, do they have weight in the department? Do they have the ability to work well with others? Do they have good relationships with other individuals in that department, or perhaps in the school or across the country, to where if you need a favor, they can throw in their power in that sense, in that end. So for example, you could be working on a study, on a project with an individual, and you might need your mentor to sort of create the introduction between you and that other individual as well. The other one I really wanted to focus on was balancing a student's distal and proximal priorities. And by distal and proximal, I'm talking about what you want to do and the methods you need to do, respectively, to get to where you want to be. So a lot of times as a master's student or as a student who wants to start doing research, you really just want to go gung-ho onto the research you want to focus on. But sometimes you need some methods, you need to gain those methods before you can actually do that research. And a great thing about working with the mentor is that they can give you some of that guidance. They can give you some projects to work on to be able to develop some of those methods that you'll need for your future projects. Another one I want to talk about is willing to critique your work. I think a lot of times it's really difficult to get revisions back from a mentor and just have what I call the sea of red, where your paper is full of red ink. I had it so bad one time that my mentor actually started using a pencil. So because she had to keep erasing and changing her thoughts. And there are a lot of times where I got a paper back and it felt like I suck. But really, the fact of the matter is that person is not trying to criticize you harshly. They're doing it because they care. They want you to succeed. They want to point out these issues so in the next round, in the next manuscript you write, you can deal with these problems up front and not have to worry about that as well. So we're talking about what an individual as a mentor can bring to you as a student, but you also want to think about what you can bring to the table as well. And again, I have a list of things up here listed. And I think the big things are you need to be the one who's taking charge in a sense. Again, as I said before, you as an individual are depending on your mentor, it's him or herself. But the mentor has all these other responsibilities as well as a faculty member or a researcher. So sometimes it's a good idea to just send an email here and there to just check in. And one of the things I actually do that really works well is when I started working with my mentor, Steve, I actually had my calendar out, his calendar out, and I said, when can we meet one or every 2 weeks and have a set time and use that as the opportunity to sort of meet up and just check in and see what's going on with our research, his and mine combined. The other big thing you want to think about is a vision for personal and shared priorities, and storyboarding may be a helpful strategy. And this is an example of Theo's storyboard, and as you can tell, it's very complex, and I'm going to tag out and let him explain what that means.
So just to describe this quickly, this is an activity that one of my current mentors has me do. Revise it every about 6 months. But you can see the main themes of my research are the gray boxes there, a mission statement to the left that leads to the goal at the right, which is to improve patient outcomes for patients with chronic and complex illness. And it has sort of advanced training on there as well. And everything is color blocked, so blue are tasks that are completed, purple are things that are in progress, green are things that are forthcoming or ideas for future research. And I think the reason that it was helpful for me was that, A, it shows initiative. It shows that I've thought things out, and it's something nice to give to a mentor. It's also something nice, as Derek mentioned, I'm starting a postdoc in a few days. And it was something very nice to give to that potential postdoc mentor and say, these are the things I'm interested in, where do we align, and where can we find additional resources? And then, so for example, let's take that first block there, and we can actually break out and tease out the specific papers. So it's a very nice concrete way of showing this is where I am, this is where I want to go, and this is what I need in the middle. Zach, did you have more slides?
No.
Okay, great. So next up, we have John Blasnich, who's going to talk about writing with peers and colleagues.
Hello, everybody.
Actually, we need to get some prompts for... Sorry, I skipped. We need... we're going to...
What?
We're going to probe.
John goes real quick. I just want to check with everyone, because I know this sounded like a really important topic for folks. Do people have any questions for Zach or Dee or anyone that the panelists up here, kind of in how they identify their mentors or any kind of facets of that process that we didn't cover? We're throwing a lot at you, so I just want to kind of keep checking in every 10 minutes or so.
Yes.
Yes, they'll be uploaded online after this.
Okay. Yes, they will definitely be available.
That actually will be touched on in Emma's section.
Hold on to that question.
Although I think it sounds like you're not saying just when you're finished with the degree, it's not working out.
Things aren't working out. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's another mentor that will work better with you, or he'll be a better fit for you.
That'll come up in my section about navigating awkward relationships. There's a whole section on that.
It's a big issue.
Yeah.
Hello again. So I'm going to talk a little bit about writing with peers and colleagues. So maybe not so much with the mentoring relationship that you've established or you're looking to establish, but the friends that you may encounter in your program or people that you meet at conferences, and you create this momentum around an idea and you want to move forward with it, and kind of as a student, how do you proceed? It involves a lot of introspection too. A big part of being a student and going through the graduate school process and thinking about what you want to do afterwards is building independence. And a lot of that means sussing out your own research ideas, your own research topics of interest, how willing you are to step outside of that and bring things in and to bring other people into that. So say you have an idea. Some questions that you might want to ask yourself, and a lot of this kind of touches on what Zach was saying, what expertise does this project require? And do you need some help from your friends? Think about who you're asking to work with. What is their work ethic like? It may be nice to get together with them and grab a cocktail at APHA afterwards, but is this something that can actually be fostered into a productive relationship? And also getting to know their goals and their interests. And again, asking, I have this idea and I know that I work well with this person in other capacities. Can this work for what I want to do with this? And say that they have an idea and that they approach you. A key question you need to ask yourself is, does this align with your current work obligations, your professional goals, your timeline, your skill set? And think about why they are asking you into the project. Another thing about the student process is publishing is great, and if it aligns with the course of your training, that's wonderful. But one thing that I really urge you to think about, again, with trying to design your trajectory while you're getting trained, is that keeping your eyes on your prize and what you're doing is getting that degree. If publishing a paper and working on something is going to either, blow up your stress rate or kind of derail you from your timeline, those are some important questions to think about, because publishing is important, but your degree is, you're not paying to publish papers, you're paying to get a degree. It's, that's a key component to think about. And that's why if you come up with an idea, if your friends come up with an idea, always check in with your mentor. Keep your mentor abreast of things. These may be something, these topics, these ideas, getting requests from friends may come from outside the lab that you're working in, but it's still important that even if you have an interest in this area, and it may not be something that your mentor does, keep your mentor abreast of what you're doing. Because you may need resources for your idea, as Zach said. Will your mentor be the senior author on this? Will they be able to advise you and provide guidance while you're moving through this process? And if someone approaches you with an idea, still checking in with your mentor, because your mentor, you know, sometimes as a student, you're like, yes, that's great, I want to do that, I totally want to do that, that sounds awesome. But, you know, you lose sight of, does this fit with my trajectory? Is this, and they can kind of gauge, you know, is this a boon or a boondoggle? Is this going to work for you? Is this something that may, you know, tether you down and take you off path? And if everyone on the paper is a novice, if everyone is a student, you might need to think about getting some sort of senior mentorship and how to move forward. So you ultimately want this. Without this, or this, or this. And so one way to get this without these three things, hopefully, because even the best laid plans may end up with Teresa from Housewives of New Jersey, is a prospectus. And, you know, Dio and I were talking about this, and it's something that, you know, I don't want anyone to think that this is like micromanaging or some sort of unnecessary stuff, because it's something that you know, was introduced to me, I've adopted it, it works so well, and I cannot, you know, endorse it enough. The prospectus is basically a plan for your paper, a plan for your idea. It lays out, you can think about, well, this is kind of what I had in my head as authorship and work plans before you start the paper. It's so important to have that discussion before you start the paper. It's an awkward discussion. It's like asking someone to the prom. I know it's weird, but you got to do it. You have to have that conversation before you start writing an introduction, methods, anything. It tells you who's on first. And typically, the way that I operate is if whoever comes up with the idea, that person, in my mind, has ownership of that. You know, my mentors have come up with an idea, and they've given it to me and said, I want you to take this. I want you to take the lead on that. And that's typically a hallmark of a really great mentor. They can recognize a project that's doable, deliverable, and they can put you in the driver's seat for it while still kind of, you know, helping you out, pumping the brakes when they need to. But the other thing is that, you know, sometimes, you know, if a friend approaches you and it may not be moving, or they may actually say, well, you know, I have too much to do, and maybe this is something we can shuffle out. Like, maybe we can negotiate you taking the lead on this now. This prospectus is a good way of being a historical document for the life of this paper and how it moves forward and how it was originally set out, and it can always change. It's a living document. But it's a way to show your leadership and a way to say, you know, this is kind of how leadership and ownership of the idea, you know, this is what I was thinking. This is how I planned it. And I know it's a little small, so I'll try to go through some of the components here, and we can it'll be online, but discuss things like, you know, the background, why is this idea important? What do you think it may contribute? What are your driving research questions? What are your data sources? And it can be this document can be as detailed or, you know, hopefully not too broad, but as you go through the process of developing these paper prospectuses, you'll learn kind of what works best for you as you keep to develop your ideas. Talking about thinking of potential journals to submit the paper to, and then of course the all-important end part that we have here, authorship and work plan. So who you're thinking will write what, and just kind of putting that out as, you know, this is what I was thinking, we can always negotiate if, you know, if DU doesn't feel comfortable working on the methods part, you know, we can talk about, you know, we'll, you know, maybe it's more the discussion things that the other authors can bring. Oh, key components. I will just glide into the slide then. So again, the intended purpose of the project is this new knowledge, things that you want to bring to your co-authors to again say that you've not only had this idea, but you're actually beginning to really develop it and have a complete invitation. It's like inviting someone to a party and not telling them where or what time they should be there. And again, the key thing in purple is to think about the authorship and what you had in mind and how you can negotiate from that jumping off point, because it's almost, you know, it's like putting a bid on the floor. If I would just sit something here and not say anything, it's probably not going to start the conversation. As a first author, you know, you take the role of leadership of developing and starting that conversation. And then the journal submission roster, that can sometimes be another awkward conversation to have.
some people are just betrothed by impact factors and think that that's what you should aim for. You know, there are other things to think about when you develop your ideas. You need to think about the review time of the journal, the paper novelty, and the audience, the intended audience. Who, what are you writing this paper about? What is the key research question, and where do you think that should best land? I mean, you know, there's a lot of conversation about impact factors, and they'll likely come up whenever, as you're developing papers and working with authors. But keep in mind that impact factors are one thing, and there are other components to your work besides trying to land a huge impact factor.
Thanks. So I just have a question for you, actually. So, you know, we're talking about working with other students, and I know a lot of us here kind of worked with either each other or kind of other classmates. You know, but a lot of us don't have our own, you know, R01s and access to, like, our own data sets. So are there specific kinds of papers that you might recommend when working with other kind of folks at the same kind of point in their careers?
In my experience, I had a really great mentor who he really excels at thinking about what questions have been asked on a lot of existing data. We're swimming in data. There's a lot of data out there, and there's a definite place for secondary data analysis. I think that it's a great beginning point for a lot of us who don't have the time. Primary data collection takes a minute. And it's not a minute that we can always shed in our graduate careers, but you know, secondary data, it's there. There's a lot of it out there. It takes some time to get to know that data. So in that regard, there's some similarities in primary data collection in that you have to sit down with the code, but think about what you're asking, and you do have parameters on what these projects have asked before and whether they fit in with what you're trying to look at. But I think that you know, looking for secondary data kinds of projects are really helpful. One of my projects from a categorical data analysis class ended up becoming a paper. So thinking about, you know, how you can marry those two things, if you have, you know, a requirement for a course or an assignment for a class, you know, you can sometimes foster that into a paper later. Of course, I lucked out because my mentor was also teaching that course. But it's definitely a possible thing to do. It's just about, you know, again, thinking about what you want, thinking about your timeline and how you want to design the architecture of your graduate career, because I mean, this is your time, this is your dollar, and apparently, I know everyone showed up at 8:30 because you're driven, and I know that people want all of this. So I mean, it'll happen. It's just, you know, it's, as a student, it's a little daunting to take that step into that leadership role, but it's something that will happen for all of you. Trust me.
Just to add to the type of paper that might be appropriate when you're working with a peer like that, a lib review article is a really great way to familiarize yourself with the state of the science in your topic area, and that might be a skill set that you have you start with that at the beginning of your doctoral program or your master's program, so you have those skills, and that's a nice type of paper to work on with a peer.
Any questions from you all, or we move on to the next? In the back.
Push comes to shove, is it worth slowing down the timeline if you can do some substantial work? I mean, how important is it to get finished in a certain time? So what are the pros and cons to that?
A key thing for you slowing down your, so maybe adding a semester or thinking about...
Or a year, or yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when we're getting a job, is there going to be a dialogue that says, you know what, you took a little longer than what we'd like to see, or is it really productivity-based?
Well, I think it's a conversation that, I hate to say it sound, you know, like a broken record, it's a great conversation to have with your mentor, because one of the just logistical issues that will come up with extending your graduate school is how you want to pay for that. So do you want more debt? Is your mentor going to be able to support you for an extra semester? And if it's, you know, and again, it's about your... Where do you want to land after you finish? If you're in an MPH program and you want to go into public health practice and maybe not research, does adding an extra semester to finish a research paper, it, do you, when you're thinking about where you want to land after that, is that worth it? As opposed to if you know you want to have a research career and go to a PhD program, maybe that extra semester to get that paper done is a viable option, is something to work toward. So again, it's just kind of that, you know, it's difficult because you have so many things to balance as a graduate student, and one of the hardest things is develop the sense of yourself in graduate school and where you want to go and where do you want to be.
All right, I get to follow up that tough act. So I will be talking about authorship ethics, and I think so things have followed sort of in sort of an order, right? But this section to me is cross-cutting, and it deals with the issues that sort of underlie the entire panel, which are authorship ethics, power differentials, power dynamics, that again are unique to the student perspective. So just an outline of what I'm going to be talking about in this section. Again, order of authorship, that was one of the questions, right? How do you deal with the order of authorship and division of labor and contribution? How do you assign an authorship, an author a position in that list? And then the politics or the awkwardness of adding, removing, shuffling authors. And then I think importantly, I'm going to point out some common pitfalls for students to fall into these abuses of power and maybe how to work yourself out of those. So one of my favorite, as most grad students know, PhD comics. This is one of my favorite comics right here. And take a second to look at this, but this sort of underlies the entire section that I'm going to talk about.
Can you read it?
Sure. So the first author is a senior grad student on the project, made the figures, did nothing else. Second author, grad student in the lab that has nothing to do with this project, but he was included because he or she hung around the group for meetings, usually for food. Third author, first year student who actually did the experiments, performed the analysis, wrote the whole paper, and thinks that being third author is fair. Middle authors, author names nobody really reads, reserved for undergrads and technical staff. Second to last author, ambitious assistant professor or postdoc who instigated the paper. And the last author is the head honcho. Hasn't even read the paper, but hey, he got the funding and his famous name will get the paper accepted. So, quick show of hands, who's actually dealt with the situation because there's felt like this? It's more common than we'd like to admit, right? So, order of authorship is a really important aspect to writing a paper and getting the paper going, and that conversation starts from the first second, at least in my mind, starts from the first second that you get that idea off the ground. You should immediately start thinking, who can help out? Where are my deficits? Unless you are the creator of a certain subfield of public health or whatever your field is, you probably will need to get by with a little bit of help, right? So think about who can fill in your gaps and where they should fit in the authorship list. But importantly, the assigning of an author is very discipline specific. So I came from a health services research field where we've got several different subcomponents. So the health economists, for example, I like to call them lone authors, right? One or two authors, and actually order of authorship doesn't matter in most econ journals, right? So it's so and so and so and so. You can't really tell who did what. It's believed that everything is sort of divided equally. Whereas I'm more of a clinical health services researcher, which I call clown car authorship. Everybody and their mother gets on the paper, and theoretically, the first author did everything, the last author is the senior author, and everybody fits in the middle somewhere along the way. So again, this is a conversation that you have with your mentor. Look at papers that you're citing a lot. You know, look at where you're going to be submitting the paper and see where things fit in. What model are you going to follow? Also, interdisciplinary researchers need to be flexible. So when you look at someone's CV, for example, look at where they published that paper to see, you know, which type of model of authorship did they follow. Did they follow sort of the lone authorship model or, again, the clown car authorship? And something that grad students are going to do deal with, I'm dealing with it myself right now, and I'm sure that our panelists have dealt with it, is just because someone is a committee member or a mentor on your dissertation project or your master's thesis, are they automatically an author on your paper? Some say yes, some say no. And again, I think that's also sub-discipline specific, right? So students in my department who are the econ track say, no, I'm doing this all myself, this is my work. Whereas people who are more in my track say, no, they actually were part of the conceptualization of the project and sort of they were on my dissertation proposal and whatnot. So of course they get authorship. Again, discipline specific. But this can be a very awkward conversation to have, so it's a conversation that needs to be had earlier. So frequently for dissertation papers or master's theses in my department, my former department, these conversations were had at the proposal time. So at the proposal, put up a PowerPoint slide and say, these are the papers that I'm expecting will come out of this dissertation or master's thesis. These are the journals, and this is the order of authorship, but this is flexible. Again, it's better to have a conversation early on so people are on the same page and you have time to mold the conversation rather than, excuse me, at the very end, right before you submit the paper, throw a curveball at someone and say, oh, actually, you're getting bumped off the paper or to the second to the last order, or second to last position. The other issue is when it is a dissertation or a master's thesis, who does the heavy lifting? Whose paper is it, right? So a lot of students have sort of an identity crisis when they're writing these papers. Well, if it's my dissertation, for example, I guess I should be writing the whole thing and I should take charge of the entire thing and I should give it to my committee pretty much ready to go and journal ready. Whereas some mentors actually disagree with that, and mine does. That was a weird conversation we had about 2 months before I submitted my dissertation where he said, no, your committee members are actually co-authors on these, so they should help out with the editing, they should help out with the crafting of the article, so don't feel like you have to do everything. Again, a very awkward conversation, but better had earlier on. In my case, I had it later on. Criteria for authorship is something that's really, really important, and thankfully we do have some guidelines out there nowadays to sort of help with the discussion. But I will say, even as a student, are these guidelines followed? Not always. So here are the guidelines for authorship from AJPH. Each author must have participated sufficiently in the work to take responsibility for the content and be willing to provide any relevant data upon request. All authors must certify that they have contributed substantially to 1. The conception and design or analysis and interpretation of data, 2. The drafting or revision of the manuscript, and 3. The approval of the final version. So again, I think most of you in the room that raised your hands and sort of said that you had those awkward situations would probably also agree that are these guidelines always followed? No. As one question came up earlier, what do you do when you have somebody who wants to put that senior person on the paper, or that big name that's, you know, there's that idea that they're going to carry the paper through the review process, which is actually a slap in the face of the review process, right? What do you do? And we'll talk about that in a second, about how you have those awkward conversations. But again, as John and I put together that paper prospectus, and John has used for years, that actually can be a really good way of keeping people accountable and saying, well, no, this person did not help out in this section. These were the deliverables that we had for this person. These were the milestones. They did not fulfill them. So maybe they shouldn't be on the paper. And as the lead author on a paper, you do get some authority to say, you know, this is how I feel the trajectory of the paper should go. This is where I feel we should send the paper. These are the people that I think should be on the paper. That said, you know, being the lead author does not come with unbridled authority. You don't get to be sort of authorzilla and just trample in and just, you know, burn the town down. You do need to sort of get a little bit of advice from your mentor and sort of work out those conversations. So, some common pitfalls for students. 11th-hour analyses, and unfortunately I've been part of all of these, and I'm sure our panelists have been part of many of these. But 11th-hour analyses, what I mean by that is, let's say a call for papers came out in JAMA, for example, right? And your mentor just found out about it 2 days ago and says, we want to get this paper out. You have 24 hours to get this paper done. Which is possible. It's been done before. But with an 11th-hour analysis, you don't have time to have those conversations and those agreements of, well, I want to work on these sections. I think my gaps are here. No, as a student, you might feel pressured by your mentor to say, oh, I have to learn how to do this, and I've got to do this, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, because my proposal is also due in 2 weeks, and I don't want to, you know, get my mentor mad at me. So, again, if you are faced with an 11-hour analysis, there's nothing wrong with saying, well, maybe we should put the brakes on this, or maybe I shouldn't be a part of this paper. There's nothing wrong with turning a paper down, but you should think about the ramifications that that might have on your relationship with your mentor. Joining a project in the paper in the middle, sort of the same thing with an 11th-hour analysis. There isn't that time crunch of an 11th-hour analysis, but there's still, it's the issue of not having enough time to have those discussions and those agreements about order of authorship and who's picking up what weight. Overpromise, though. Only negotiating with one other author on the writing team, so I've actually been a part of this too. And the issue with that is that if things aren't in writing, or if everybody on the writing team isn't clear, someone can promise you, oh, well, you'll be second author, but little do you know that they've already promised second authorship to someone else on that paper. And as the least senior person on that writing team, you do get bumped, or you get bumped off of that paper. So again, only talking with one person is not the best idea. Send an email around to the senior author. Send around an email to everybody on the authorship list. In my mind, there's nothing wrong with being transparent. Overpromising and under-delivering, that's pretty self-explanatory. The next one is the fun one, the revise and resubmit purgatory, right? So in that period, the paper just getting rejected or the paper get, you know, going through a revise and resubmit, that's the time when, you know, people can say, oh, well, you know, let's reshuffle the authorship list because this person helped out with this revise and resubmit. This person really recrafted the paper. But again, these are conversations that should have happened earlier on, so that you don't get neglected in that sort of weird process. Remote collaboration. So John did a great job talking about working with peers and colleagues, which I think we didn't do a good enough job talking about. That's actually one of the most positive points of this panel, is that you can have a lot of great experiences working with people who are in the same position as you that are trying to reach the same end goal. That said, remote collaboration, you want to make sure that, again, you keep a very strong paper trail of who's doing what and what are the milestones, what are the delivery dates, and hold people accountable. And the last one is an interesting one. So, but I need a first author paper too, and this can happen on a number of levels. So that can happen with your peers, right? You've got your good friends. So let's say I'm working with John on a paper, and John says, well, I'm coming up for a promotion, or I'm going on the job market. I really need that first author paper. But I'm actually the one who did all of the work, let's say. This actually isn't a real situation. We actually work well together. So what do you do in that situation? You might feel bad about that. You know, you really want to help your friend out because you're going to be in that situation, and maybe he'll help me out in a year or two when I need to go up for that promotion as well. But I would say really advocate for yourself. Go with the ethics of the situation. Who did the most work? And there's nothing wrong with the second author paper. That can also happen with, let's say your mentor is an assistant professor who's going up for tenure. Same thing. You did all of that work, but that professor takes that paper from you. Again, that paper trail can be very, very critical for you. So negotiate authorship. So remuneration, I generally think of in these situations as that being authorship. But if papers are part of your RA-ship, for example, then make sure that you have things written out at the beginning of the semester, at the beginning of the research relationship. These are the papers generally that I'm thinking about. Again, I'm type A. I'm the one who does the storyboarding. So I think it's a really good opportunity to get things on paper and get people aligned on the same page. Be explicit about the necessary clearances, so IRB, ethics training, data use agreements. I fall into situations when collaborating between several universities where, you know, things fall by the wayside because I wasn't included on an IRB proposal. My name got kicked off of a paper, even though I'd done all the analyses, which that's a whole other conversation. But again, when you start a paper on the prospectus, there's a section on it that talks about what are the things that you need. Do you need IRB clearances? Do you need DUAs? Those are things to work out. You might think of those as sort of, oh, it's part of the paper, but not really. But actually, it is part of the paper because the paper is the end product. Be explicit about the workload and deliverables. Again, the prospectus can save you in this situation. So, you know, having that box at the end of the prospectus, which you'll see, which we'll post online, you know, keep a documentation, put dates on people, and keep them accountable. This one actually is very important, especially for those of us that are working with new authors, or people that are new to us. Check out their history, right? Look at their articles on PubMed or whatever database that you use in your field, and see what their papers are like. Do your priorities align with theirs? And what I mean by priorities is, let's say that you're a methods whiz. So let's say you're like Zach and you're an epidemiologist, you're a methods whiz, and you're working with people who are more content-oriented. There might be a little bit of a discrepancy, right? If Zach really wants to come in and have really strong methods, he wants to have propensity scores and instrumental variables and whatnot, they might not care. They might just need a descriptive paper out, and that's what they want, and there might be a clash there. So again, look at the types of papers that they want, that they generally publish. Ask them where they want to go with a certain paper to avoid those awkward conversations. How many authors are typically included? Again, we talked about that, looking at people's CVs, looking at where they publish and whatnot. This can help you, this can be sort of your background research to have smoother conversations with people. So the fun part, negotiating disagreements. When awkward things come up, how do you get around them? And I will say that as a student, you know, there is that idea, and I think think the model in education is changing where students are a little bit more proactive. Students can have a little bit of a stronger voice than years prior. But still, it is very awkward to go against your mentor. It is very awkward to go against that person who advocates for you and who really, for most intents and purposes, has your back. But that might come up. So the first thing is modifying the authors list, shuffling, removing, or adding authors. What happens if you get confronted with a situation of, you know, we want to add this senior person at random university that we think is going to carry the paper through? Again, that perspective can come into play. You can say, well, I don't think that they fulfill enough of the authorship criteria for said journal to merit authorship. And I'm actually going to open up this section to all of the panelists. I'm going to go through this section, but I'm going to open up so that we can get some more discussion on this, because I'm sure we've all been through these situations and we can all offer different perspectives on this. But neglectful mentors or senior co-authors happens more often than we all would like to admit. That said, I've been really lucky having a great primary mentor. But again, keeping a comprehensive paper trail, keep things by email or in hard copy so that you know, well, these were the deadlines, this person did not live up to it, this is where they were supposed to help me out, this is where they were supposed to mentor me, they were supposed to get me this data set by this date, things didn't happen. Again, be very explicit. The other thing, and this comes up, you know, John talked about this, what happens when you have a lot of novice authors? You need someone to sort of be that advocate for you or that mediating party. And we have this on the prospectus as well. But identify that potential mediating party from the get-go. So if you're working with either novices who are all at your level or intermediate level, whatever level you're at, or if you're working with senior authors, right, you need to have someone who might be able to step in and help you out if things get awkward or uncomfortable. It's great to identify that person from the get-go and have them included in the discussions a priori, but this is not, you know, again, the sky is falling. This is not sort of getting ready for doomsday. It's just, you know, to help the process go along as smoothly as possible. That said, it can be very awkward and can be even more disruptive to include that mediating party if things do go bad. Sort of might send a sign to your mentor or your other authors that things aren't going well, and it might be seen as sort of, I don't want to say slap in the face, but it might, right? They're not doing their job well enough. Let's say you're working with your primary mentor and he or she is not fulfilling their promises, and you get somebody else senior in your department to come in and say, hey, Dr. So-and-so, you know, your student has been working on this paper for over a year and a half. What's going on? What is that going to do for your relationship with your mentor? I think the biggest thing when we're in the student role, and this can be about a paper, and this can actually be general advice about anything, is think about what your end goal is, right? Before you send that potentially awkward email out, what is the goal that you have in mind? Are you trying to mediate the relationship? Are you trying to just sever a relationship? Think about what the potential ramifications are, how that person might perceive that message, and what that might do to your relationship and your productivity in the future. So I talked about this earlier, lead authorship does not equal unbridled authority, right? So show initiative, be that first person. You are the senior author, it was your idea, or you are the charge for that paper, but be open to, you know, kind of tucking your tail between your legs when necessary.
Well, thanks. Well, I'm going to certainly kind of, you mentioned a lot of good stuff I want to follow up on. And actually, the first question I want to ask all the panelists to get to an earlier question in the audience was, so, you know, do you all have instances where you felt it was necessary to kind of, you know, gracefully bow out of a paper, or you kind of had to formally sever a relationship with a mentor, you know, like, and if that happened, like, how did you do that in a way that didn't kind of, you know, scar you, or it lets you kind of continue being productive?
Well, I can talk about severing a tie with a mentor. I kind of liken it to breaking up with your hairstylist. In a sense, it's an awkward conversation, but it has to be done. So when I actually started off before public health in the field of health communication at Ohio State University, and I chose a mentor. In all honesty, I chose a mentor because he was the token gay professor in the department, and I was a token gay student in the department. So I just thought, oh, we're gay, we're aligned, you know, we'll be cool, and it didn't really work out like that. And pretty much my 2 years during that program made me realize, you know, I kind of wanted to have more real-world experience. And my mentor at that time assumed that I was going into the PhD program. I had early admission, And I pretty much made the mistake of telling him a week before my master's defense that I was leaving to take a job at an HIV service organization. So I really just had to kind of put my tail between my legs, using the metaphor that Theo described, and I set up a meeting with him and sat him down and just said, you know, I need to tell you the truth. I really want some more rower experience, and I'm leaving after this defense to pursue some more opportunities. And he was actually, he took it a lot better than I thought he would, because I think he realized, your mentors are pretty smart. They can pretty much tell what's going on. And he knew our relationship was sort of maybe perhaps falling apart in a sense, because I wasn't really sure what I wanted at that point. So I think that my advice to anyone who has a relationship that needs to be severed is think about why you're doing it. This isn't working. It's better to get it done earlier. Like, if you have a hairstylist who's giving you a crappy haircut, why are you going to keep going back to him or her? You just have to, you know, be strong and just go on. And I'm doing the Obama pen thing. I'm doing it. Like, I've presented a couple times, and I keep doing the... But, yeah. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking.
I think I can talk about severing a relationship as well. So there, I had one relationship that wasn't going that well. And it had not been going well for probably about a year. And when I started seeing it going sour, that's when I really kicked up the type A and over-attentiveness part of me, where I kept things in paper form, and we started writing those prospectuses. But, you know, when two papers came out, sort of, I was noticing that I was getting bumped down in the authorship list unnecessarily, right? So I had done all of the focus groups, I had done all of the preliminary work, I had done some of the data analysis, I'd written most of the paper, but somehow I was getting fourth and fifth authorship. So that's when I involved my primary mentor, which was really awkward because these two people, my primary mentor had been this person's mentor some 20 years ago. They were really good friends. She and my mentor's wife would play bridge together. I mean, it was an awkward conversation to have, but I included him and said, look, this isn't working out. And at first he didn't want to believe me. He was believed in the good of this person, but sort of when he started seeing the trajectory of how I was getting bumped down in the authorship list, but I was still working 30, 40 hours a week for this person doing most of the work, he sort of backed me up, and he started interjecting himself in the email chain too and saying, well, if Dio is doing this paper, he is going to get first author, correct? And it was a yes or no question that she had to respond to. So again, be very explicit and try to have someone advocate for you. And, you know, yes, I missed out on maybe two more papers, but for me, I can make up those papers elsewhere. It was not worth my mental health.
Yeah. You have a great mentor who really does advocate. I just wanted to add, too, I did a BS to PhD program, so my program required a master's along the way, and so I was initially assigned a mentor from the beginning, and after I completed my master's, I realized for my doctoral work, I really needed to go in a different direction, and so I think that as students, too, it's important for you to kind of give yourself permission to do that. It felt like a divorce. It was horrible. There were tears. There were angry emails. But in the end, I ended up with a mentor that really helped me get the skills that I needed and get me to where I needed to be. So I think you just have to give yourself permission to do that. I mean, you know, I think that the mentor-mentee relationship is a unique kind of one, and you know, you've got to advocate for yourself if it's not working out.
Back.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I already finished my master's and I'll be applying for a doctoral program in a couple of months, so I'm starting to do the after. How does the IRP process work if I'm not in school anymore and I'm thinking about interviewing people for
That is a great question. So I think it depends on, you know, are you working with people at a certain university that you can have them front the IRB for you? That might be a good method to get through. So if you're working with one of your mentors, I'm not sure where you're at, but have them front the IRB and then you're put on as a consultant, for example. I don't know if you still have an affiliation with your former university. That might be worthwhile as well. But yeah, have those conversations with the person who sort of is acting as your sponsor or your mentor for this project.
Project. How would that affect my
You will need IRB approval to get your work. Yeah.
I can add to a bit of that. So when I graduated from Ohio State in 2010 with my MPH, I was actually thinking of starting a follow-up study for a study I did during my final year there during my MPH. And I had that concern because I was going to do qualitative interviews as well, and I had 3 months between going from Ohio State to UNC. And actually, the best advice I can give is just talk to potential schools that you're thinking about and talk to their IRBs if this is something you're really interested in doing. And also talk to the MPH program. I think you said it was an MPH program you just finished? I would talk to that university as well, because what Ohio State told me to do was to submit an IRB with them, and then when I finally did go to UNC, I could use that IRB approval from Ohio State to further my case for continuing research at UNC.
I can just add to that. Sometimes you can get a memorandum of understanding between the IRB and the two institutions. So they might be able to just accept the IRB from the previous institution if you get an MRB.
I wanted to bring up a question on Officer Ethics, and if you can put us on understand if you want to hop up. I'm actually a director of PhD program in epidemiology at the University of Florida, and we've recently redone our program. Requirements. Students at UF, like many places, have the option to do a dissertation that three papers, and that would be packaged together in a dissertation. The issue that's come up is the involvement of the dissertation committee members on these papers. If the same members are responsible for approving the dissertation for graduation as they are for authorship. In epidemiology, we have a lot of team science, so a lot of students pick people who really will be involved in kind of creating and shaping the idea, and who will meet the criteria for authorship and want to participate. Not all committees have that. Some committees have people who are less engaged. But the issue is, there are some in our group who believe that it is a conflict of interest if all authors can be on both the dissertation approval process and the writing of the papers. But that puts that in the student in a position of telling certain dissertation committee members, you cannot be a co-author, no matter what you do. And I really wonder if this is an emerging ethics issue we've never heard this before, or any thoughts about that potential conflict.
My program had adopted that when I was going through. We had the option of a book dissertation or three publishable paper option. And the sentiment when I was going into this was that because this was my dissertation first, that I would have to do all of my work. After those were finished, during the proposal time, thinking about when these were finished, if there were committee members who wanted to work with me further with them to develop them and get them out the door, the chair was involved the entire way, but if there were other committee members who wanted to do something afterwards. But again, it was kind of, what you touched on, it's my experience was different from my friend's experience who defended their proposal 2 months before me. I mean, it was very idiosyncratic to the committee. We had a lot of parameters put down by the department and the school for what we needed for graduation, but the actual mechanics of getting those papers out the door and what that means for the student were really unclear. And we were just kind of told, these are conversations for your committee. But I agree that maybe this is something that needs, a broader clarification for people. I think that a lot of programs are moving towards models like that.
So we have one more panelist who's going to give a mini presentation.
Okay. Hello, everybody. So my name is Emma Mitchell. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Miami School of Nursing and Health Studies. I'm on my second year in the tenure track, and I want to talk a little bit about what it's like to navigate the transition of going from being a student to going on in that direction with your career if you choose to go that way. So before you graduate, you want to be able to, you want to try to maximize your connections at your institution. And what I mean by that is when you're a doctoral student, you're so, or a master's student, you're usually so focused in your one area that you may be aware of the other research that's going on around you, but not able to really fully take advantage of it. So the example from my experience was one of my dissertation findings related to violence, interpersonal violence. And I found out after I finished that someone who hadn't been on my committee was a real, you know, expert and emerging expert in the field at the University of Virginia. So I was able to sort of strengthen that contact before I left, take it with me. We wrote a grant in my first year at the other institution, got funded, and were able to collect some more data and continue that collaboration. So you have, you know, sort of two different situations. If you remain at the institution where you did your doctoral work, you want to focus on doing more independent publications, leading up publication groups. You want to differentiate yourself as not just a student. You want to help to sort of use those publications as a way to help, you know, solidify your role as a faculty member and as more of a peer with people who previously may have, you know, had you in class or whatever else. If you go to a new institution, it's really important to try to balance wrapping up old projects and showing productivity with the people you've been collaborating with, but also showing some sort of allegiance to your new institution, right? That's what they like to see. They like to see that you can come and network and work with and collaborate with and publish with people at your new place on their data, as well as bring some of your data with you and share that as well. I wanted to talk a little bit, one of the questions was about publishing dissertation papers. It can take time, obviously. Some people, as we were mentioning, some programs allow you to write a three-paper chapter or option instead of the traditional book. This can be really helpful, but it's still going to need a lot of work once you finish and are actually shopping the papers around. One tool that Dio and I have talked about in terms of finding a target journal is there's a website called jane.org, right? I can't remember what it stands for at this point. But it's a search engine that can help you if you upload the title and abstract of your paper. It can help you through sort of a word search matrix, I believe is how it works. It can help you give a broad stroke idea of what a target journal might be. I think that with dissertation papers, a lot of programs that offer the three-chapter option or the three-paper option will require you at the time of your proposal defense or your ultimate defense to name which journals you're intending to submit your papers to. I think it's a good idea to have a list of several that might work for you. That's been my experience. I've needed to go to several journals for some of my dissertation papers. So I think that not being frustrated and trying to continue to work with mentors from your doctoral program or master's program, and also trying to take advantage of what some of the resources at your new institution might be can be really helpful. So some strategies, with negotiating or navigating your new faculty role. And again, we talked about maintaining the working relationship at the previous institution. Before you leave, have a clear idea. The perspectives that Dia mentioned would be a wonderful tool to try to keep everything on track and keep everything as straightforward as possible. Clarify your expectations before and after you do start at the other institution. And again, we've talked about a lot of these strategies throughout the presentation. Some strategies to begin networking for publications once you get to your new institution might be you're going to obviously familiarize yourself with which publications are coming out of the institution, who's publishing what's the general area of research that's going on, who has data that you may be able to get involved with and continue that publication trajectory from the institution. Also, a lot of institutions have journals that they're affiliated with. Consider becoming a reviewer for that journal, and then you get a better sense of what the sort of types of papers that the journals accepting include. So, for example, we at the University of Miami School of Nursing and Health Studies have a journal called Hispanic Healthcare International. And right when I actually came to UM, they had a special call for a specific area of health disparities research, and so I was able to get a paper in on that. And also another strategy we use is we use writing teams. We get together every 2 weeks and have a running document of all the papers that people affiliated with our Health Disparities Center for Excellence are working on. It helps you to stay accountable to yourself and to your peers in terms of keeping track of who's publishing where, what lessons learned there are from which journals, and you know what people's experiences have been. So, all right, that's it.
Well, I have a question for you, and I think this piggybacks to what someone had mentioned like an hour ago. I already forgot, but so you know, a lot of us have transitioned from masters to kind of doctoral programs, and kind of if there are nuts and bolts about that transition, but also just even kind of within the context of programs, there are a lot of natural transitions, like when you're done with your coursework, and then you're kind of just floating around there for like a year, being like, what's going on, and kind of how can you still maintain. I think you talk about these relationships and really maintain that level of productivity.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point. I think that a lot of people struggle with that. I think that, you know, Dio talked about some of the strategies that he uses to stay organized. I think that there, you know, it's going to be kind of an individual thing, but I think reaching out and having peer connections to, again, keep yourself sort of accountable to that, support each other, and that kind of stuff, I think is really crucial. I had the wonderful pleasure of having my chair, he had three other doctoral students at the same time, and every other week we met for lunch and would talk about, you know, research issues, what we kind of would call ourselves peer debriefers. So we'd meet every other week and we'd talk about what issues we were facing, you know, what some of the things going on at the school were, so we felt still connected to the school. But also it was kind of a time to start socializing us into the role of being a faculty member, so our chair would talk about you know, we kind of had a theme to each of the meetings. So one might be like how to be productive as a faculty member while you're balancing committee work, teaching, and scholarship, and things like that. So I think a peer network is really helpful in that situation. I don't know what you guys want to add.
I think a lot of these issues, so you were talking about the student to faculty transition, but I want to stress the point that these issues are also very salient to people going from the student to postdoc experience. I'm facing it now, and John has faced it too, I'm assuming, as a postdoc. But also, some of these issues are also going to face people who are going from the master's to the PhD level as well. So these issues permeate throughout your course as a student, professional.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions about this from class? Before we kind of move on?
Yeah. Yeah, there's kind of a related question that a couple of us have brought up about becoming a reviewer. How do you become a reviewer? How do you get your put in the journal to do that?
I think that's a great question. I think a lot of journals are looking for reviewers. They will usually have in their website a section where, or a link that you can submit your CV, submit a letter of interest. Sometimes they'll have a fill-in form. But basically, I think,
that's a new idea.
Or since,
yeah. Let's be published in the area to be a reviewer in a journal. Like, I'm currently a communications director for a major state agency, the biggest one in the state. I have a communications background. I've learned to review academic journals. But I'm not published yet. I'm in my fourth year of my doctoral program. So I don't know like how to cross the bridge and say, hey, I want to be a reviewer and get more involved. But by the way, I've never published an academic journal in my life.
Yeah. I just wanted to speak from our perspective as American Journal of Public Health. What you really want to do is get experience being a true reviewer. And the way to do it oftentimes is to work with your mentor. So if your mentor is asked to review a paper, sometimes they'll say, you know, I have a really great student. Is it okay if I use her? Because then you'll actually get the experience. Because there's the logistics about going to the website and signing up, and anybody can do that. You just go to the AJPH website and you can sign up and be a reviewer. But when the editor looks and sees that you haven't published, it's not that you won't get an opportunity, it's just a little bit harder to get an opportunity. So it's kind of like improving your credit rating. You know, things kind of happen. As you get more income, it goes up. As you pay your bills, you're kind of, you know, it's not your self-worth how many papers you're asked to peer review. But as you start to publish, once we get one of our authors publishing, we think that is the give back that you review. Once you have published in our journal, you are hot stuff. So, you know, and so don't feel
I've actually, I can speak to that. I've done that. My mentor, three of my mentors actually have allowed me to tag on to papers, and at first they didn't submit my name with the review as well, but then after I kind of got better and got the hang of it, one of my mentors actually started saying, Dio Cavalierto has reviewed this paper with me, please add him to your database if you thought this review was helpful. So they actually got more bang for their buck. They got two reviews at once, and it was a great experience for me. We're going to close off the session with just some overall tips to writing. We've thrown a lot of information here, but this sort of is a little synthesis and it's just some broad-level ideas. So we've talked about this a lot, and again, I'm type A, so I like timelines and storyboards and prospectuses, but you know, one of my favorite quotes is, an idea without a plan is just a dream, right? It just won't happen. As PhD students or master's students or busy professionals, we've got so much coming at us, so make sure that you have that timeline and you stick to it, and you have other people to help you keep accountable. Reduce the period between rejection and resubmission. This actually was a tip from Derek, but it's an important one too, right? Sometimes, especially as a doc student, let's say you started writing a paper in your second year, and then you start taking comprehensives or qualifying exams, that paper will go down to the bottom of your list, right? Especially if it's, you know, in between, if you just got rejected by one journal, you need to revise it and send it somewhere else. Make sure that you keep that paper at the top of your priorities so that the data don't get old or stale, so that your findings are still policy, practice, or research relevant. And this one was actually really helpful, and some advice from my mentor. As you're working on side projects, try to integrate them as much as possible with your main project. So again, my area of interest, primary area of interest, is palliative and hospice medicine. So I used most of my course papers, for example, to help me build in, you know, to do a lit review on this, lit review on that, lit review on that. When I started writing my dissertation proposal, which then became the first chapter of my dissertation, which now might become a lit review paper in and of itself, I had pieces that I could pull here from there, and it actually made me more productive and more efficient. Learn to say no. This one is a really important one. As students, you know, again, all of you are here this morning, you're driven, you're productive, you're energetic, and you're motivated. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying no to a paper. It might not be the right time, it might not be the right paper, it might not be the right co-authors, you might not bring the right skill set. You don't have to do it. You don't have to save the world. Someone else can do that paper. Don't worry about it. And if it's going to derail you in any way, shape, or form from your end mission, then it's time to reconsider. Keep a living catalog of paper ideas. I do this. So anytime, you know, I'm on the bus or on the treadmill, I get a paper idea, I immediately write it down. Yes, I'm an amazing texter, and whenever I'm on the elliptical. Keep an idea, and actually, you know, it might come back to you. You might reopen that document in 6 months' time and say, oh, I heard about this data set, or I heard about this person doing this. I met them at APHA. And that's a great way to not lose track of the ideas that you have in mind. The next one, don't be afraid to disclose your student status to a journal. So again, we've talked a lot about the power dynamics and the awkwardness and sort of the things that are unique to students. And at least anecdotally, what I've heard from a lot of students is, I'm afraid to send a paper out to AJPH. I'm afraid to send a paper out to JAMA, to New England. Well, maybe not New England, but I'm not sure if those too high. But no, you know, I'm afraid to send my paper to these top-tier journals, right? But that shouldn't necessarily, if you've got good work, right, if you've got good ideas, fresh ideas, energetic ideas, there's nothing wrong with sending it out and sending it through the review process that will make you stronger and make your ideas stronger. And to be entirely frank, you know, so the American Journal of Public Health is thinking potentially about, you know, rewarding the best student paper of the year, for example. We won't know that unless you disclose that you are a student. So there are pros to actually disclosing your student status. It's nothing of a less than sort. If the paper isn't good, it's not going to get in, regardless of you being a student or senior author. And last, do not compare yourself to your peers. Everybody is different, and this is something that we've all done. I've done it, right? So if I compared myself to the publishing history of Zach, for example, Zach's an epidemiologist, right? They happen to write differently than people in my field do. I'm an interventionist, right? So it takes me longer to get things going. I have fewer papers. I do more qualitative work. He has more papers. But we all do different things. And I think it's a big pitfall, even within your own department, even within, you know, people that are mentored by the same mentor. We all do different things. We all have different sort of trajectories and different writing styles. And I think the biggest insult you can do to yourself is try to compare yourself. We all bring different, unique strengths to the table. So I think that's all for right now. But I do want to take... Yes?
You mentioned that you talked about the imposter
syndrome. Yeah, so this is something that I've carried for years, is the imposter syndrome. Who here is familiar with the imposter syndrome? All right, enough of you. So the imposter syndrome is basically the idea that you are fake, right? That at any given moment, it's sort of going to be like the emperor without his clothes on. You're going to be giving a presentation, and, you know, at your dissertation defense, someone's going to find one flaw with you and just, you know, nail you. And that's going to be the end of you, because they found out that you've been fake for so long. And I think as students, we have that. We deal with that a lot. It's the same issue with disclosing your student status when you submit a paper or whatnot, right? Do not be afraid of that. Students are the next generation of public health professionals, and we should be proud of that, and we should reach out for opportunities to be mentored. That's why we're in a PhD, a master's program, right? Because we realize that we do have deficiencies and gaps, and we want to fill those in. So try to get rid of that imposter syndrome, even though I still deal with it on a daily basis. I do want to take this chance to first, me personally, having been the chair of the session and put the session together, I want to thank the phenomenal panelists who I'm also very thankful to call my colleagues, and I think we're thankful to call our colleagues in this room, but also as friends. I do want to thank the AJPH and APHA family, the editors here, Dr. Northridge, Dr. Kapadia, the editorial board members here, and Brian Seltzer, who is the managing editor, or I'm sorry, what is his title? Yeah. He's basically the superhero of the journal. Yeah, he's everything. And our phenomenal mentors who have guided us through along the process, we would not be here without them. So again, I want to thank everybody for coming out this early, and I think we're going to open up the floor for questions at this point. Oh, actually, I do want to save some time if there's a response from the editors of the editorial board, if anything we've talked about, get your opinions.
This is my 24th APHA meeting in a row, and this is the absolute best panel I have ever heard in my entire time here. And one of the things about being at this meeting is we've been really trying very hard to be accessible. So, you know, we're here, my deputy editor, Farzana Kapadia. We're not all this old. Some of us are that old. And, you know, when I started editing the journal, I was a doctoral student at Columbia University. And Mervyn Susser was the editor-in-chief. And after a number of years, they decided to do editorial transition. And 2 months a year, he would go to South Africa, one in the summer and one in the winter. And everybody said, well, you know, can Mary Northridge really run the journal? And I said, well, I kind of do it 2 months out of 12. And so at any rate, they chose me to be the interim editor, and after a national search, I became the editor-in-chief. And I, you know, have been with this journal for a very long time. We have a very diverse, dynamic group. We have great editorial board members that are really engaged, you know, and we really care about public health. And, you know, these names, I know these names. And we're doing another issue of the American Journal of Public Health with Rob on homelessness. And these are just really, wisdom was at Columbia, stop about it. This is part of our family. So I just want you to know that probably the best papers I wrote, and I mean this, I wrote as a doctoral student. And one of my most cited papers, Contribution of Excess Smoking in Harlem, I wrote my very first year out as an assistant professor. And I just heard from somebody at the Mailman School of Public Health, because she's a friend of my daughter's, who, by the way, is now a physician looking for an adolescent medicine fellowship. Match on November 7th, so. And she said, oh my goodness, your mother wrote the paper that we're using in my class. And it was the paper that I wrote when I was, you know, earlier in my trajectory than you are. By the way, Wahoo Wah UVA Virginia. I'm a Wahoo. Oh yes, Equa Scholar right over here. So I'm just trying to say that, you know, we're here, we really care about you. We can't always be as polite over email. One of my things that I just would take a little bit exception with is if you have something hard to say, don't do it over email. You know, pick up the phone. And, you know, my partner is a lawyer, and all his cases are built on email. It should be a lesson. And our database gets subpoenaed, so anything we write in there could go to the tobacco industry. So just really be careful in your documentation. If it's a conversation that you need to have that's a little bit difficult, I'd write an email. Are you available for a phone call? Something like that. But at any rate, we need you all, we love you all, we want you all to publish in the American Journal of Public Health. We have lots of different formats. We have online only. You can do a systematic review now with the American Journal of Public Health. We have public health policy briefs, which are very short, 10 references, 1,500 words. A letter to the editor, that's publishable. You know, if you have a little finding, you can have one table or figure. I always say for students, start publishing your thoughts, your perspectives in that way. Our departments are so underutilized. And we have the greatest department editors. And so if you're a historian, you can do a Voices from the Past. It's not even peer-reviewed. You can do an Images of Health on something that you care about, not even peer-reviewed. Work with the editors to get it done. For the peer-reviewed Imprimatur, if it's original but it's, you know, exploratory, hey, go with a brief. And our analytic essays are really hot stuff now. I want you to publish with us. I'm going to put something in your ear, Framing Health Matters. Take a look at it. Sophia Gruskin does Health and Human Rights. We're doing a whole issue in January on the right to choose. And I think you're just a natural match for us, and I just want to encourage you. They're already with us. We're going to publish Epidemiology and Injury. We're going to do all the work that you do. So I would also say to ask your mentors, what journals in your field do you need to publish in? I always used to poo-poo the American Journal of Public Health. You know, that's not the be-all and the end-all. At schools of public health, actually it is. If you're at a school of public health, publish in there, at least part of the time. But now I'm at a college of dentistry. Where do I need to publish? You know, JADA. I need to publish in these other journals now. So just, you know, talk to your mentors about what journals you should publish in. That's a really good idea. Then, I really like Lisa Metz. She's in my field. I look at all the journals that she publishes in, and I'm like, okay, write that down. You know, so if you have somebody that you are really impressed, write down where they publish. It's another good idea. So I'll turn it over to the other editors or board members if you have anything to say. And we're here to, you know, talk with you, to share with you whatever it is that you need, because, you know, the journal is only as strong as the people that contribute to it and that use it.
Chiefs in medical centers who are publishing at first. but things that other people didn't write, threatening to faculty with their tenure if they didn't yield for a scholarship. So keeping it very short and bottom line, you'll be experiencing some of these things consistently. Hold your ground. Publication is about your participation and the quality of what you do. And when push comes to shove, shut back.
Yeah, my name is Bob Kipper. I'm one of the associate editors for the journal. One thing I just wanted to mention about is that, you know, as you go through the process of publishing, you are going to get then back from us and the peer reviewers comments. And one thing that I'm always fascinated with is, in my mind, the range of and degree of reviews of a paper. Sometimes it almost is you're wondering if, you know, if this is the same paper that they got. So that to realize again, you have to exercise the wisdom of what people have come back to you as peer reviewers on. I think you need to give a good response back to the questions that they raise, but it doesn't mean that just because they raise the question or say suggested something different, that that's where you have to go either. That you can respond back, well, look, we thought about that, but we did this. So I want just to give that aspect to you too, that you don't be dismayed sometimes with what you get and sometimes even conflicting things that you get. We as associators are oftentimes scratching our heads too about how best to be able to integrate that into decision making in the paper itself.
I'd just like to add, I mean, the first time I got a review back, I'd never received one before, and so I just went, oh, well, what's reviewer one have to say about it? And I was like, and I got back to my mentor, I'm like, Rob, I apparently this paper is just terrible. I'm like, he's like, well, what's the designation? I said, I'm looking at the reviewer comments. He said, well, what does it say? And I said, it says revise, resubmit.
Right?
And he's like, that's the key point. But these comments are so harsh. And he's like, scientists are reviewing your work. He's like, you know, some people can give criticism very well. Some people will just, you know, lay it like a brick on a table. And the thing that the way that I've kind of developed is I'll read them, and I need a minute. Mm-hmm. So I'll walk away, you know, I'll think about them, because, you know, you do, even if you disagree with them, you have, as a scientist, you have to substantiate empirically why you were taking your point, because, you know, the onus is on you. So if someone didn't understand it, as the author, you have to make it in a way that they understand it. So it's hard when I first read this to not feel like it was personal, but it's not. It's about making very good science, and learning how to receive and to respond to that criticism is really kind of an art, and it's an art that you learn as you go through the process. And your mentors are great with helping you get through that too.
I know it's 10 o'clock, and so I want to respect folks' time, but I'm pretty sure everyone here is going to hang out for a few minutes if you kind of want to do Q&A, but, you know, I've given you permission to leave. Being rude, just